This is Learning from Genocide, a series brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. In these episodes, we will be giving a voice to just some of the incredible stories of human endurance in the face of evil. I'm Rachel Century, Head of Research for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and over the next few weeks, as well as talking to experts who have dedicated their lives to raising awareness, we'll also be hearing from those who have survived the Holocaust and atrocities of Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur.
My dad and the rest of my family who went didn't survive because the Serbs came in and killed them.
I remember my mom holding on to me so hard. I can still feel my hand hurting now because she was so worried about losing us in the crowd.
These are the first-hand stories of the people who were there and who, against all odds, survived genocide. Hello, and welcome to Learning from Genocide. In this episode, we explore just two of the stories from a tragedy still very fresh in the minds of the people who were there. The Bosnian Genocide refers to the crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing campaign carried out during the Bosnian War of 1992 to 1995, which included the killing of more than 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica, as well as the mass expulsion of another 25 to 30,000 Bosnian Muslim civilians. Despite not even being born at the outbreak of the war, my first guest's life has been shaped by the atrocities. Una Srebrenica Ryan is a British Bosnian whose biological father was killed in the Bosnian genocide. Her birth mother was very young when she fell pregnant, and so Una was adopted at 6 months and moved with her adoptive family at the age of five to the UK. In 2016, she met her biological mother, and it was then that she learned of her father's name and saw his picture for the first time. She is with me now. Una, when did you first become aware of your family history?
Ever since I could remember, my adoptive mum always told me that I was adopted, that I was special and that I wasn't in her stomach. And I guess I never really had many questions until I turned a teenager. I had a lot of questions about who my birth parents were and where they are and what happened. And she actually contacted my birth mother when I was 16 through Facebook. But because she wasn't friends with my birth mother, the message went into a different folder. So my birth mother actually never saw this message until maybe just a few years ago, actually. So the whole time, this message was in her folder saying that your daughter wants to get to know you. Do you want to get to know her? She's fine. She's healthy. She's in school at the moment. When I was about 16, I saw on Facebook the pictures of my birth mother and my family.
That must have been really moving for you.
Yeah, it was nice to be able to see who I kind of resemble and do I look like my brothers and my sisters because my mother got married to another man. It was nice. I didn't really know what to think.
And can you tell us anything about your father? What do you know about him?
So I didn't actually get to know much about my father until recently. So when my mother finally saw this message in her message request folder, I was able to go and see her. She lives in Australia. And I got to ask her about my father and what his name was and whether he died in the war and what happened. And she was able to give me a name. So I went on Remembering Srebrenica website and there's a load of photos and names of the victims. So I scrolled down and I tried to find his name. And then that's where I saw his picture for the first time. So I kind of took a picture of him and I said, is this him? And she said, yes, this is him. And then the following year, I got to find my biological grandparents, so my father's parents. And they never knew I existed because my mother was very young when she had me and she gave me up for adoption. When I met my grandparents, they were able to tell me more about my dad, what he was like. I got to see another photo of how I looked like him. They only have one photo because of the war and it destroyed their house and things like that. I don't know much about him, unfortunately, but I know that he was very young when he died. He just turned 17.
What was it like for you meeting your birth mom?
It was a bit surreal. It didn't feel real. because for so many years I thought that I'm not going to see her. And when my adoptive mother sent this message to her and she didn't reply, I thought, okay, this is it. She doesn't want to get to know me. And then when she finally saw this message in another folder, that's when we agreed I can go to Australia to see her. And when I saw her, it's just, I think for so many years, I didn't think that this would happen. So it just kind of felt like a dream. But it was really lovely to see all my family and to see the similarities that I have with my mom and my brothers and my sisters. And then I get to meet all my other cousins and my uncles and my aunties. So it was really lovely.
How soon after meeting your mom did you meet your dad's parents?
So that's when I went to Bosnia the following month. I got to see my dad's parents for the first time. And it also was a bit surreal because I didn't think it would happen this quick. I only found out about my father like a couple of months before, and then I finally seeing his parents. They were really pleased that I came and that they got to find me, because it's like a gift that my father has left, if that makes sense.
Definitely. So, it must have been so emotional for them. They lost their son but found now a granddaughter. And so they're still in Bosnia. Was that your first time in Bosnia?
No, I come to Bosnia regularly. I used to travel to Bosnia a lot when I was younger. My mum would come back because my adopted mum is Bosnian as well. So my adoptive family is all situated here as well.
And so once you knew about your history, your family, do you feel more connected to the history?
Yeah, definitely. Because I didn't really know a lot about the Srebrenica massacre and a lot about the war in Bosnia. And when I got to find out that it did first-handedly affect my mother and my father, I did feel such a connection to that. So yeah, I feel very much more connected to the victims. And I found out that it wasn't just my mother and father that were affected, but my grandparents, my biological mum's brothers died, my cousin's dad died. It's just so many deaths in just this family, and then other families as well. It just equates to a lot. So yeah, I definitely feel connected.
I want to ask maybe a difficult question. You say your family died. Were they victims of the genocide? So, you know, they were murdered, or were they victims of the war?
I think most of my family died from the Srebrenica genocide. So what happened was that my father and my cousin's father, they sought help with the Dutch UN officials in Srebrenica when the massacre was just happening. And then the rest of my family went through the forest. Some of them didn't survive. Some of them survived. But my dad and the rest of my family who went with the Dutch UN didn't survive because the Serbs came in and killed them. They were victims of the massacre in 1995.
And how do you know that? Has your birth mother told you the family story? Is it through your own research?
My birth mother told me that she met my dad in Srebrenica and I was conceived, and then the war happened and she was put onto a truck to go to Tuzla, which was where I was born. And my dad, because he wasn't a young child, he had to kind of fend for himself and run away from the Serbs. So that's when I learned from my biological grandparents, my dad's parents, that this is what happened to my dad. They took him away from my grandparents and they said, you know, you're old enough to fight for yourself. You're not a child. You're not allowed on these buses that will take you to safety. I know most about my dad from my dad's family.
Is it hard for them to talk about it, and hard for your birth mom?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I have to do a lot of research myself because they don't like speaking about it a lot, and I completely understand. But I'm so interested in what's happened and why this has happened. They really don't like talking about it just because it's so fresh. Even though it happened about 26 years ago, these people still would have been alive today.
Of course. Had your mum managed to tell your dad that she was expecting?
Unfortunately, no, because when the massacre happened, my mum was only, I think, 2 or 3 months pregnant, and she didn't know she was pregnant until 5 months along. So my dad actually never knew that he was expecting a child. And it always haunts me to this day what would have happened if he knew that he was expecting a child? Did he know that he had someone that he's going to leave? And yeah, it's very upsetting.
I know it's very difficult. I think your dad would be very proud of you. You're doing amazing research into the family story and you're sharing your story. And Una, tell us a bit about yourself. What do you study? What's life like for you now?
When I was adopted, my adopted dad is from the UK. So my adoptive mother, who's from Bosnia, they moved to the UK. And that's where I kind of grew up. And I would come to Bosnia every so often when I was younger. And then when I started school, that's when I really did settle in the UK. And this is where I think my life would have been different if the war didn't happen. You know, I wouldn't have been able to move to the UK and have a future in the UK. I don't know if I would have gotten my degree in the UK and studied what I studied. I ended up studying psychology at university with criminology, and I graduated a couple of years ago. So I do think if I was brought up in Bosnia with my family, my life would be so different to what it is now. I'm actually here in Bosnia at the moment, visiting my family. I think my goal is to just spread as much awareness of the genocide as I can, because a lot of people don't know that it actually happened. A lot of my friends, they'll say, oh, I never knew about this. Can you tell me more? People think, okay, the Bosnian War and Srebrenica genocide, but there were so many other towns that people were murdered. You know, it's not just Srebrenica. It's not just the war in Sarajevo. It's so many other places. And I think that's for the future. That is what is my goal to do, to just raise awareness. You know, after the Holocaust, they said never again. And unfortunately, it did happen again.
And by talking to me, to our listeners on this podcast, you're doing that already. So lovely to meet you.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you too.
Smajo Bezo was born on the 29th of March, 1985, in a little town in Bosnia called Stolac. His early childhood was an idyllic one, but it wasn't to last. And Smajo, at the age of only 6 years old, was thrown into a world of torture, killings and fear. A world where the men in his family, including his father, were taken away and put into concentration camps. Smajo joins me now. And let's start with life before the genocide. What do you remember of life before everything changed?
Childhood in Bosnia was really incredible. I always try and make the point and I explain to people that Bosnia was a normal, modern European country, and we had everything that we had here. And Bosnia actually hosted the Winter Olympics a year before I was born in 1984. And I always remind people of Tove Lundin becoming the highest scoring figure skaters of all time and household names. And as I said, Bosnia was just a normal, modern European country, and childhood was incredible, living in the countryside. So my family actually comes from a little town called Stolac. You know, having the freedom of the countryside, running around, and really I didn't differentiate between people's skin colour, ethnicity, religion. My family is predominantly Muslim, but we also had Catholics, Orthodox Christians, we had atheists, we had Jewish family members, and all of these holidays and religious holidays were celebrated together. So we'd celebrate Eid, but then we'd also celebrate Christmas with our family and friends. And so in Bosnia, we have two Eids, two Christmases, because Catholics and Orthodox Christians have Christmas at different times. Then we had two Easters. So like, childhood was absolutely incredible. And we always did the same thing, a lot of food and dessert and then presents. So we do the same on Eid and same on Christmas. So childhood was absolutely incredible.
So was there a defining moment when all that changed, when you realized things were somehow different?
Yeah, so in the early 90s, we had just moved into a new home that my parents designed and built. My parents actually had an opportunity to go to France to work, and they thought, why would we want to leave this? You know, they had worked so hard for so many years to achieve this. And obviously there was things happening in the background that as a child I wasn't aware of, and your parents are always shielding you from those things. So I didn't understand the context at the time. In reality, the tensions in Bosnia started maybe even 10 years before when Tito died, and Bosnia was part of Yugoslavia. So when Tito died, the Nationalist Party started coming to power. Slobodan Milosevic, who was the Serbian nationalist leader, that started utilizing this nationalist formula and started dividing people. And, you know, by the time you got to the 90s, that divisive language became part of the everyday discourse. And, you know, it was completely normal for Serbian and Croatian politicians to equate Bosnian Muslims as disease and vermin. And again, I wasn't aware of those things because my parents were so busy trying to shield us from that, and my brother and sister. And I think also there's that belief that because we had this amazing multicultural society, so out of all the Yugoslav republics, Bosnia was by far the most diverse. And I think there was always that belief that it can't happen here, that it happens somewhere else. And I see it today as well in the UK and parts of Europe where people think that we are so different from what happened in the 40s during the Holocaust, what happened in Bosnia in the 90s, or what happened in Rwanda and so on. And when I'm asked what is the first thing that we can do to prevent what happened in Bosnia happening again, is that acceptance, actually, that what happened in Bosnia, what happened in the 40s in Europe can happen again. So there was a lot of these things happening in the background that I wasn't aware of. But one of the sort of most distinct moments for me personally was we had just moved into our home, and it was 6 months before the official start of the war in Bosnia. And I was playing outside with my brother and sister, and I ran into the house, and my mom was just sitting in front of the TV and she was crying. And I remember seeing something on TV. It was a balcony, there was protesters, there was flags, but again, I didn't fully understand what was happening. And I ran up to my mom because, you know, you don't want to see your parent upset. And I remember my mom, she hugged me and she kissed me, and it was like she always did before, but I just remember how tightly she hugged me that time, and she kissed me on the head and she said, you know, don't worry, go outside and play. It was nothing. And again, being a child, you just kind of listen to your parents. And I ran outside. And I think it was only in 2016 that I started speaking to my parents more actively and recording their experience that I realized actually my mom was watching news reports of war spreading across parts of Croatia and parts of northern Bosnia. And she knew she was completely helpless. Like, there was nothing she could do. And she knew that it would come to us, but she couldn't help us. And that was one of my memories that I always went back to. And then gradually you start hearing, you know, shooting and bombs and shells in the distance, and they kind of getting closer and closer and closer to us. And another memory that I had, my uncle bought me and my brother a dog. It was a German shepherd, and we called him Lessie, and we were incredibly protective of him. I remember there was always big discussions. There was always gatherings, and people usually gathered in our home, you know, our cousins and uncles. And even when I'd wake up late in the middle of the night, I'd still see the light on in the living room, and there's these discussions, and I'm piecing things together. And I remember once it seemed like our whole village was in our home, in our living room. And I remember asking my mom, what is going on? What's happening? And she said, someone's dog had escaped. And for me, that was like the worst thing she could have told me, because I was so obsessed with our dog. But in reality, what had happened, it was a Serbian war criminal. And there was rumors that he was in a neighboring town. He's called Vojislav Šešelj. He was actually at The Hague, and he's back in Serbia now. But there was rumors that he was in the neighboring town, and people being slaughtered and killed and raped. So to protect me, she told me someone's dog had gone missing. But in reality, like, if she had told me that it was this war criminal, I probably wouldn't have understood, because these things were very abstract ideas for me. It was things that I saw in history books, things that I saw in TV. Trying to protect me, she literally told me the worst thing that she could have told me, because I couldn't stop thinking about this. But then gradually our town was surrounded by the Serbian army. It was the Yugoslav National Army, but controlled by the Serbs at that time. And then again, when bombs and shells start falling around you, when you see dead bodies, when you see the crater leaves behind, when you feel the explosions, like, you know what war is, you know what bombs are. Like, no one needs to explain it to you. So even as a child, you pick those things up very, very quickly. And no matter how much your parents try and protect you, you start piecing things together.
Can you just tell us who was in your family at that time? Who did you live with? Did you have cousins nearby?
So my family lived in a little village in Stolac. So Stolac was a municipal sort of area. And as part of that area, we lived in a little village called Barane. And my village was predominantly Bosniak, and vast majority of those people there were Bessel. So they were family. This was, you know, uncles and aunties, but then all the distant family members. So we had lived with my grandmother and my uncle, and then me, my brother, sister, and my mom and dad, we moved into our new home that they had built. And my mom looked after us, and we had a lot of land. So my mom worked the fields as well, and my dad worked in a factory nearby.
And when did it become clear to you that you and your family were being persecuted?
I think that there are several moments that, again, without anyone having to explain them to me, that I knew something wasn't right. One of the sort of key moments was, so our town, our village was actually surrounded, as I said, by the Serbian army. And initially, these were people that my parents knew, that my parents worked with, you know, friends, people that would come over for tea and coffee every other day. You know, these are very close-knit communities. But then these people started arriving, but they were just wearing uniforms and guns, and that was the difference. And one of the sort of key moments was when a soldier friend who had been over so many times before, he came over one day and I saw him entering our gate, and I ran to him because he would always bring me chocolate and sweets. And so I ran to him excited to see him. And, you know, as a little boy, you know, he had his uniform and his gun, and you kind of look up to that. It's the thing that you saw on films and cartoons. And this day, he just kind of pushed me away. And he was ranting about Bosnian Muslims killing someone somewhere, doing something. And I didn't fully understand it, but he got his knife out and he started sharpening his military knife out. And he said, today was a good day for cutting throats. We were just like screaming and shouting and, you know, we're scared. My dad wasn't there. And just by chance, we had a Serbian friend who was also a soldier who was nearby and heard what was happening, and he came to rescue us. So that was like one of the earliest moments while we were still at home. Then one of my dad's cousins was taken away to a camp that was set up on the outskirts of Stolac, and he was beaten, tortured. No one really knows what happened to him, and he passed away, and then we had to escape. And in the first 9 months of war, we escaped more than 14 times. And again, without any planning, without knowing where we were going or what we would find, but we just had to move to stay alive. It was really as simple as that. My dad became a soldier, and he wasn't a soldier. He worked in the factory before the war. And the first year of living as refugees, we lived with one of my uncles on the outskirts of town. And at this time, it was the Bosnian Muslims and the Croatians jointly fighting against the occupying army, which was the Serbian army at the time. So life was incredibly difficult in that period, but there was still that belief that we would go back to our homes. And my mom locked the front door. I've still actually got our key here in Newcastle with me, because at that moment, we never dreamt of being anywhere else, let alone the UK. We always thought we'd be back. So a year into the war, actually, the Croatians this time started recording Bosnian Muslims. So me, my brother, sister, my parents, we were all photographed and given an identity number. So again, as a child, I wasn't fully aware of what this meant. And obviously for my parents, I can imagine, again, the pressure and the anxiety of seeing what's about to come, but being completely helpless.
And how old were you when all this was going on?
That was the spring of 1993. So I was 8 years old. And then by July of 1993, the Croatians started rounding up all Bosnian Muslim men in Stolac and in that whole region. I think the youngest was just 13, so just a couple of years older than my brother. And the oldest was 90. Two of my cousins were 16. One cousin was 17. He was taken to a former hospital that was set up as a place of torture, and he was kept in the basement with other minors. I think in the first 4 days, two of his cousins, who were also kids, died in his arms. Literally 24/7, he would hear torture and beating and screams. Several of my uncles were kept there and other cousins. And when his name was called on the fourth day, he was walking through the basement. He thought to himself, that was it. He wasn't going to survive. And he was walked into this room, and he opened the door, and he saw four of his neighbors, so his parents' friends, literally like people that he grew up with sitting there. And he said he smiled because he thought, oh, they've come to rescue me. But they did the most awful and inhumane thing. So literally all Muslim men and boys were taken from Stolats. It was one of the biggest networks of concentration camps since the Holocaust. And obviously, at the time, we weren't aware of this. I just knew my dad was gone. We saw trucks leaving the center of town. We ran to the road, again, naively as kids, you know, excited, thinking that these were soldiers going on a mission somewhere. And I remember my sister actually seeing my dad on the truck, and she was waving. And I was frustrated because I didn't see him. And actually, when we ran home to tell my mom what we had seen, you know, everyone started coming over. And at that point, I remember, like, I felt we were invisible because the adults are there discussing what's happening, and there was none of that protection and trying to shield us. So I heard awful things, that they were all going to be killed and executed, thrown into pits and caves. And we were staying with my dad's brother, with my uncle at the time. And he wasn't in the army because he had a bad back. He was injured. And the next day, soldiers came to take him away, and we wrapped ourselves around him, me, my brother and sister. And we begged and begged. And my sister, I remember my sister screaming, "You've taken my dad, please don't take my uncle. You've taken my dad." And she just kept repeating it over and over again. And they just took him again. So all of my male relatives were literally gone overnight. And we heard, as I said, the most awful, awful rumors. So women and children actually remained behind for more than a month until the 4th of August, 1993. And we had soldiers come to our home, like, literally every single day, threatening to kill everyone, threatening to rape everyone. One day there was a soldier that came, and he had a massive samurai sword, and he said he was going to chop all of our heads off. I remember one day my sister being so scared when these soldiers would come, because I said they would threaten us with all sorts of things. I remember she was so scared. She actually tried to jump from our balcony, and my mom just managed to pull her back at the last minute. And I don't know whether she would have survived that fall. So that period was absolutely awful. And whenever I'd wake up in the middle of the night, my mom would always be sitting and standing by the window, because she'd be guarding the house, worried that soldiers would come, that they would torch the house, that they would kill us. And she would hear all these awful things happening throughout the night, because Croatian nationalists then destroyed the whole urban core of Stolats. Like, destroyed archives, museums, the mosque, which was more than 500 years old, completely destroyed. That whole historic core, even the foundations were dug up just to erase every trace of our existence. So she could constantly hear this.
Absolutely terrifying. What happened to make you leave your home?
On the 4th of August, soldiers came, and we were forced to march to the factory where my dad had worked just before the war. And there, my mom was forced to sign this document. So we were all searched, family at a time. You know, we saw young girls and women being singled out. I remember my mom holding on to me so hard, holding on to me and my brother and sister. I can still feel my hand hurting now, because she was so worried about losing us in the crowd. And she was forced to sign this document that she was giving everything up for safekeeping. And I've actually got that list. I actually found that list a few years ago, and I've got it here. And on the list, interestingly, it says that she gave up 2 pairs of earrings and her wedding ring for safekeeping to the local council. And obviously, that's not the only items that were taken. The earrings were actually my sister's, and they were given to her by my granddad before he passed away. And it was the only memory she had of him. And we were then loaded onto cattle trucks and dropped off near Bosnian government-controlled territory, just south of a town called Mostar. And there along that route, I saw awful things as we were marching, because we saw elderly sitting by the side of the road, just unable to walk anymore. This is like August of 1993, so temperatures in Bosnia get above 40. And I remember vividly seeing elderly crying, sitting by the side of the road, and there's hundreds of people there already. And I stepped over what I thought was a pile of clothes, and as I looked to the left, I could see the full mattress lighting off. It was a body of an old man, and I remember distinctly he was wearing the same suit that my granddad would always wear. I still remember the shirt that old man wore, and I just remember thinking that moment, is my granddad in this crowd somewhere? Is he able to keep moving, or has he been already taken away? And then starts a whole new chapter of that war period during the siege in Mostar.
Had you heard any news of your father at this point?
So we tried through our Croatian friends to find out what had happened to them. We didn't have internet back then. We didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have Facebook. And it was so information was difficult to come by. We tried asking through our Croatian friends, but sadly at that time, all of our Croatian friends just kind of forgot us overnight. Maybe it was fear. Maybe these things just consume society. And I always say, really, that month, the only sympathy that we saw was from animals, you know, because our dog Lessie, he was incredible. He could just sense when shelling would start, you know, he would sense when soldiers would come, he would start barking and howling and we would hide. So he was incredible. So we didn't hear from my dad until I think the first time we heard that he was alive was in December of 1993. So several months after he was taken, and we heard that my dad was in a camp called Dretil, one of the most notorious camps in Bosnia. It was known as the Camp of Death. And I think out of, I can't remember how many thousand, maybe 15,000 prisoners in total in that whole network, out of several camps, 500 were selected to be taken to an island off Croatia for treatment. So these were 500 in the worst condition, ones that were tortured, beaten, awful, awful things that had happened to them. And my dad was actually one of those. So we had no idea where he was or what had happened to them. And as I said, we heard awful rumors, but you kind of hold on to that belief and faith that he was still alive and that he was still out there somewhere.
And how did you manage to escape Bosnia and be reunited with your father? Because we know that he thankfully did manage to survive the camp.
The next sort of period of war was probably even harder, I would say. So after sort of several weeks of living in ruins, wandering around, me, my mom, brother and sister, we settled in a town called Mostar. And Mostar is famous for its old Ottoman bridge. And the siege of Mostar is not spoken about enough, I don't think. But the siege of Mostar was incredibly difficult. You have a very small geographic area, and Mostar was surrounded by the Serbian army on one side and the Croatian army on another side. And again, kind of well-known war strategy by concentrating such a high number of people in a very small geographic area, something like 60,000 people, and you bomb and shell them daily. If they're not killed by bombs and bullets, well, they're going to die from disease, starvation. So we settled in Mostar, and we were lucky that we settled with my mom's sister, with my auntie, Amina. And again, in comparison to other people that literally stayed living in ruins for a whole year. So it was actually in June of 1994, the British Red Cross came to get us, and we had literally 2 hours to make a decision whether we wanted to leave or stay. So my dad was taken out of the camp, taken to an island of Croatia for medical treatment. And then he was told basically he could go pretty much anywhere in the world, apart from the Middle East and Africa, but he couldn't go back to Bosnia because Croatia was worried that if these men went back to Bosnia, they would become soldiers. So the UK was part of that program, and he was taken to the UK, and he was told that he would be here for 2.5 years and we would be reunited with him as part of that program. And I always like to make the point that if it wasn't for the people of the UK, we probably wouldn't be here today, because it was people that campaigned to bring us here. It was people that organized, protested, wrote letters to the British government, the Croatian government, the UK government. I've even got letters from Jim Cousins, who was the MP of Newcastle at the time, where he's describing me, my brother, my sister, and my mom and dad as his constituents in April and March of 1994. I didn't even know where Newcastle was at the time. And for me, that is absolutely incredible. And we had so many amazing people helping us. So yeah, so as part of that agreement, on the 19th of June, we left Bosnia. They came and they told us basically we had less than 2 hours to make a decision. And by that point, there were so many people reliant on my mom, and my grandparents were there. She obviously wanted us to be reunited with my father. And Srebrenica happened a whole year after this. So we spent a month in a refugee camp in Croatia, and we arrived in Newcastle on the 19th of July, 1994. 1994, so a year after my dad was taken away. So my dad left Bosnia on the 19th of January 1994. We left Bosnia on the 19th of June 1994, and we arrived in Newcastle on the 19th of July 1994. So the number 19 is our lucky number, I think. Back in 2016, we started actively talking about this, and I started recording my parents' story. My parents still struggle because that trauma is very much real. It's not something that happened in the past 27, 28 years ago, and that's it. That's over. You know, that trauma is very much real. It's very much in our present, and it will definitely be in our future. So it's incredibly difficult for my dad to speak. But I think understanding the importance of speaking, because really in Bosnia, we haven't had justice. We have so much genocide denial, so much revision of what happened during the war. We have war criminals openly celebrated in Bosnia, that I think my parents got to the point where, as difficult as it was for them, they realized the importance of the work that I did. So when I started sharing my story and doing this work 6-7 years ago, I didn't tell them initially because they were always so worried about this. So my dad has spoken to me about the things that he has experienced in camp and some of the ways that he was tortured and beaten. And it's literally the most inhumane things that you can think of, some of the things that were done to him and my uncles. And I won't go into details, but I would like to just say one thing. One of the things that was done to my uncle, my dad's younger brother, repeatedly, Croatian nationalist fascists would heat up needles and they would stick them underneath his fingernails. And that was probably the least cruel thing that they did to him. And he spent more than nearly a year in several camps where he was tortured and beaten and awful things happened to him. So, yeah, I think we're getting better at speaking about it because I think my parents understand and they want to use our story and our experience really for peace building. That's how we would explain it here, because I always say peace isn't just the absence of war. I think peace is the actions taken to prevent war, and that's the biggest difference for me. So I think my parents understand that they can use their experience for good, and the UK has been our home and the UK has been so good to us that we want to contribute in that way.
So your family thankfully did make it to the UK. What's life like for you here? What do you do for a job?
So my primary role or job is teaching architecture at Newcastle University. So I do that now several days a week. But also my other kind of main passion, if passion is the right word to describe it, is educating about the Bosnian genocide, doing anti-racism work. So I've been doing this now actively for about 6-7 years. I speak in schools, charities, organizations all over the country several times a week now. I think for Holocaust Memorial Day in January, I did about 30 talks and events here in the Northeast, and that's probably the most I've ever done in a single month. But I literally do hundreds now. I'm very passionate about this work. But also, I think for me, because I was 9 when I came to the UK, for me, it was a lot easier. For my parents, they struggled because they wanted to learn English and they wanted to contribute positively. But because we only got indefinite leave to remain in 2002, my parents actually had to quit college to look after us and to be able to provide for us, because there was always that fear that we'd be just sent back to Bosnia any moment. And I've got photographs of the first time we visited Bosnia in 1998 and our house was just a burnt out shell. For me, it was easy. And I studied architecture and it's what I do now alongside this work. And I also do research at the university on Bosnia and the Bosnian genocide. But for my sister, well, my sister was 15 when we arrived. For her, it was a lot harder. She came and she was doing her GCSEs straight away. And she actually did okay in her GCSEs. She started volunteering for a charity working with refugees and vulnerable people. After college, she started working for them, and she still does this today in Newcastle. My brother, he was 11. So again, he was older, but easier than it was for my sister. He went on to study biomedical science at Newcastle University. He did really well, graduated with a first. He then went on to study medicine and now works as a GP in Newcastle. But for me, none of those things would have been possible, again, if we didn't have the amazing people helping us, because my parents couldn't help us write personal statements. They couldn't help us with career choices. That I knew I wanted to be an architect, but how do I go about doing that? So we had amazing teachers that helped us. And I always use this one story as an example of the help that we got. In 1994, so when I started school, I couldn't speak a word of English. So I was 9 years old. So I was in year five. And my teacher, her name was Claire. I actually met her for the first time in 2018 again, and we do a lot of work together now. She's amazing. And she was like full of life. She was this amazing character, and she just loved teaching. And that was clear, but I couldn't understand a word she was saying. And she had this thing at the end of each day, we would all gather around her. She'd get her guitar and she would sing this song. It was actually a Jewish song. It was a song initially sang in Hebrew, but she would sing this song. She would say someone's name. And I figured out that they would get to go home first. I couldn't understand what they were singing though. And everyone was so excited. I hated it. You know, I was depressed. I was having nightmares. I missed my grandparents. I missed my family in Bosnia. I wanted to go back. I didn't want to be here. And I started having English lessons separately. So one day we sit down and everyone's excited, and they're even more excited than usual. And I hated it even more because I think they were so excited. So she started playing the guitar and they start singing. And this time they start singing the song in Bosnian. So when I was out learning English separately, she went through this effort to teach like her whole class how to sing this song. I mean, I literally, it was the first day in such a long time that I went home with a smile on my face. Like when you've had the support that we've had, the community in the Northeast, especially the Bosnian community, we're like this invisible community. People don't even know that we're here. And the reason why we're this invisible community is because we've had the amazing people of the UK help us to integrate. And I did this project a couple of years ago where I was asked about my identity. And I said, I feel 100% Bosnian and 100% Geordie. I've always been bad at maths, but that's obviously wrong. But when you've had the support that we've had, when you're allowed to be what you want to be, then it's impossible not to want to feel like you belong and not want to feel like you're a part of this amazing community. So for me, that's just one instance of the so many amazing acts of kindness that we had here in the Northeast. And that's the reason why I do this work today.
It's such a beautiful and uplifting story. And as you say, it's a part of why you want to share your story. What does it mean to you to be able to tell people what happened to you and your family?
For me, I started sharing my story as an act of justice, or trying to find justice for my family, because as I said, vast majority of the perpetrators of war crimes, sadly, are still living in the same communities that they once terrorized. So really, for me, it started off with that, because we've never had an opportunity to share our story in court. And my grandparents died without seeing justice. And my auntie, my mom's sister, was actually killed 23rd of January 1994. And we know that the perpetrator, he's living freely. We know that actually he's living in Croatia, and Croatia is an EU member state. Even though there's all this evidence there, we've never seen justice. So it started off as that, for very kind of personal reasons. And over time, I realized actually my story can be a tool for peacemaking, because for me, that's what I believe this work is. Peace isn't just the absence of war. Peace is the actions taken to prevent war. And when I do my work at schools, I always ask the kids, what is war? And they'll always give you loads of these different answers. But when you ask, what is peace? That's always harder to define. Like, and you sometimes get a few blank faces and people looking at each other. And for me, peace can be something simple. I explain them. It can be smiling at someone when you walk down the corridor. It can be helping someone with homework. It can be what my teacher did in the 1990s. That is peace for me. And I feel like actually using my story and our experience can contribute positively to maintaining peace here, because peace isn't just given. And for me, my mom and my auntie Amina, who was killed, and my grandparents, they kept reminding us of our values during the war, because sometimes people see refugees and people in wars and so on, and they forget that we actually hold on to our values, our beliefs, our morals even more. So when we were surrounded in Mostar, when we were shelled and bombed daily, my auntie and my mom and grandparents reminded us of what we stood for, what kind of world they wanted to live in after the war, what our beliefs were, You know, I always think back to those moments. And for me, this is a form of justice. And I feel like I can actually help combat hatred, rising anti-Semitism, Islamophobia in this country. And there are so many positive things as well in this country. Another thing, Radovan Karadzic, the Serbian war criminal, he's actually serving his sentence here in the UK. And that's another incredible, amazing thing that we should be proud of. So, yeah, so I do it for personal reasons as well, but also because I believe my story can be a tool for peace in this country.
As always, I'm so grateful to our guests for sharing what will be painful memories with us and for the work they do to educate the world to stop things like this from happening again. My thanks to Smayo and Una for talking to me today. In the next episode of Learning from Genocide, we'll be hearing about the tragedy of what happened in Darfur when the systematic killing of ethnic Darfuri people occurred during the ongoing conflict in Western Sudan.
And there I made the greatest mistake of my life, which I regret to this very day, because instead of insisting she stays, I allowed her to leave.
Until then, goodbye. Learning from Genocide is produced by Amanda Redman and is brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and Trafalgar Strategy. For more information on the stories that you've heard today and ways for you to be involved in what we do, please go to our website, hmd.org.uk.